You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
My name is Len Witt, and I'm a professor here at Kennesaw State University. I have an endowed chair, and I was hired here in 2002. So I'm going to just give you a little background of how social media changed a lot for me. Okay. So I put on a conference here. I came out of Minnesota Public Radio, and my last job there was as the executive director of the Civic Journalism Initiative at Minnesota Public Radio. And my job was to bring people together, talk about public policy issues. Not a lot unlike we're doing here, but on, you know, public policy issues that people sometimes might not want to talk about. That job ended, and I got this job here, and we were in this thing called public journalism, which was to teach journalists how to reach out to the public, because they weren't doing a good job of that. But the movement was sort of a little bit in flux. You know, it wasn't doing that well. And this guy who runs this particular site now called Locally Grown, his name is Griff Wigley. Let me see if we got a... Maybe he's taking the picture here. He's actually taking the picture, so he's not in it. But he was doing social media stuff for a really long time. And he said to me at this juncture where public journalism was kind of going down the tubes, he said, Len, this was in 2003, he said, we ought to start a blog. And I didn't know what a blog was today. I mean, everyone knows what a blog is, but then I didn't know what it was. And he said, yeah, just start a blog. And I didn't pay attention, and then I went into it. And so every day, it looked a little different back then, but I had this blog. And in the beginning, nobody came to it. You know, I just kept blogging and blogging, and I would do a search for public journalism, and I'd come up at page 15 or 28 Google, and I would call him up and say, this is a waste of my time. And he said, no, just keep doing it. And so I kept doing it, and then over a period of time, not like that quite today, but, you know, sometimes in the past, I probably spelled it wrong there, but it'll come up right. So, in the past, often, if you typed in public journalism, which was this little, small, defined niche market, I would come up first. And even so, only Wikipedia is in front. Which meant that anybody in the world who wanted to understand or know anything about public journalism came to me, just by this. And even though a lot of other people knew a lot more about the subject than I did, I tell people I own the international franchise on public journalism. And so I kept blogging and blogging, and another thing that was going on with that, it was also, I tell people it's like a public file cabinet. I put everything in there. And someone else in a writing workshop I was in one time said that he puts all of his clips into a little box, you know, that he reads about interesting stuff. And he says that's like a compost heap, and it just kind of keeps working, and then fertile soil comes out of that. Well, that's kind of what happens with my blog. So on a personal level, I'm doing that, and it's kind of this little compost heap with all kinds of stuff. 2 months from now, when I need a piece of information that I kind of forget, I can search it, find it on the PJNet. And I started, you know, getting inquiries from around the world. And so I knew I had the worldwide franchise. And the first good thing that happened is I got an email from Eric Sampson at the Universidad de San Francisco in Quito. And he, in Ecuador, and he emailed me and said, I've been reading your blog. I never heard of the guy. And he said, would you like to come down here and do some workshops on public journalism? And I said, yeah, but I'll charge you this much. And I knew he couldn't afford that. So he said, we can't afford that. And so I wrote back and said, all right, give me an apartment for 3 weeks. I'll do a week's worth of workshops for you, and then I'll hang out in Ecuador for 3 weeks. And they said, fine, that's a deal. And so that was my, you know, this indication that now I own the sort of worldwide franchise. But this is also building not only for me, but it's building sort of social capital, because I get to know Eric. I get to know his students. The students get to know about public journalism. And we have this dialogue back and forth. And a whole group of people around the world and around the United States who I wouldn't have known, I started to get to know through this. And then I came up with this idea, and I told you about it this morning, but it's called representative journalism. And I didn't want to do it. I kind of told you that too. I think I actually took it down. Let me just see, maybe it's over here. But I had this video on it that said, you know, steal this idea. I don't know if you can read that there, but it says, steal representative journalism idea, because I didn't want to do it. Even in the beginning, I just wanted to, you know, talk about it. And then, as I said this morning, Ruth Ann got in touch with me. She left a comment on my blog, and then she called. And I didn't know who it was, and I looked it up and found out, I know who she is now. She has this $10 million family foundation. And we started talking, and she told me early on, my husband's affiliation is with Baruch College in New York City. And as much as I like what you're doing, Kennesaw's not going to get any money. And I said, I don't care. I don't really care about the money. This is a little something that somebody told me. If you're looking for money for a nonprofit, if you ask for money, you're going to get advice. If you ask for advice, you have to get money. So, and I really kind of believe this in some way. So I never kind of pressed the issue very much. And then I was with her when she gave Baruch College $1 million. I was there when she gave him a handwritten check for $1 million. Wow, that's pretty good. But at that same meeting, this was a couple weeks ago, she had me take the pictures when she gave and said, all right, now Len, you come around to this side, I'll take some pictures of you. And she gave me a check for $250,000 for my property. And I thought that was the end of it. But then afterwards, she called me and said, no, you don't understand, this is continuing funding. I'm going to give you more. And she had asked for a proposal, and I had sent her a proposal with three pieces to it. One was the silver idea, bronze idea, and gold idea. And actually, one of the foundation people said here, well, ask for more. You know, ask for what you really, really want. What would make this happen? I said, well, you're not going to give me that. I said, just write for what you really, really want to happen. What do you think that you can do this job the best for? And so that's a proposal I wrote, and lo and behold, you know, it got funded. It's a miracle. You know, I tell people, if it's a miracle, I can't believe it now. And so now we have this $1.5 million. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with everybody, you know, or because it's a miracle, but who knows? So that's my story. But there's also a bigger story behind all of this stuff that's going on. And we can talk a little bit about some of the sites, because what my issue is to try and figure out ways to ensure that journalists can work and get paid for the work. The old business model's changing. The old business model said 86% of news was paid for by advertising. That's disappearing. So who's going to pay for journalists? I'm trying to figure out, well, if they produce something and it's got value, why shouldn't people pay for it? That's my belief. And everyone says, well, it's crazy. You can't get people. I keep saying, well, look at how much hair I have. It cost me $20 to get a haircut. Why wouldn't people pay for news? You know, and that's sort of the mission that I'm on, to try and figure out how to get people to pay for information that people work very hard to create. Yeah.
It's great. I mean, congratulations on getting such a big amount of money. But I guess my question is,
sure,
somebody who's out there on the ground and working, is what are you going to do with it? Because with all of the resource poor community, you know, journalists, citizen journalists, journalists who've been laid off, what is your plan to do with that kind of?
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to get too much into that because I wanted to talk more about. But I can give you a brief idea. The way it's set up, it's this money comes over 5 years and it's front loaded. So the biggest chunk comes the first year, a little less next year, a little less next year. We're going to hire a research director, a business development officer. I used to work for Minnesota Public Radio, Garrison Keillor, which is really a nonprofit, but they know how to keep themselves substantial, and you're not going to get a lot of money to come in to do the mission, to create the mission. And so I watch what they do, and so you have to kind of, there's a couple things.
What are the name of it again?
Nonprofit. Minnesota Public Radio, NPR. So one of the things that I learned there for a nonprofit, never go hacking.
They won't do that.
Never go what?
Hat in hand. So, oh, please give us some money. We need money. Their attitude is, and it's an attitude that I try and have, is I'm going to do you a service. You've got money. You're a foundation. You want to make sure you invest your money in something smart. I'm going to give you something smart. But I'm not begging you for money. And I'm not going to say please and thank you over and over again. I'll say that. But that's what I'm going to deliver. And here's the deliverable I have to give you. And I also found out with a lot of these foundations and people who know it from working in Minnesota Public Radio, the more you get, the more you tend to get. Again, because foundations have been burned so often that they want to make sure that their money's going into a kind of trustworthy place that does well. So the other thing I do is like, you know, you think, well, we're going to have some foundation people over. Maybe we should look poor. No, you want to look like we have something going on, you know? If you give us our money, you're going to get really good returns from it. So that's one of the public face that you have to give, but you really have to believe it. It's not just making it up, you know? So that's, you know, some advice for doing that. Now, what are we going to do to fund journalists? There's all kinds of, and this is where the social capital comes along. So when I was blogging this idea, there's a young kid named David Cohn. And he's about 23 or 24, but he liked my idea, and my idea is to get small communities of, let's say, 1,000, we'll use that number, to come up with $100 each to pay for a journalist. And we'll supply the journalist, the editing and everything else they need. That's basically it. It could be a small community like Northfield that doesn't have enough news reporters, or it could be people interested in endangered species, okay, in a place like Florida. Are there 1,000 people there who'd be willing to pay for a journalist? We'll supply the journalist. Well, David liked the idea, but his idea is that he uses this thing called Spot Us. So he came up with this idea, and there's the Night News Challenge. Anybody ever heard of the Night News Challenge? Okay. All right. So the Night News Challenge every year gives away $5 million for creative, innovative ideas. And you put your idea in there. And I actually got to the second round this year.
What's called Night? What's called Night?
K-N-I-G-H-T. Night News Challenge. And they're going to just come out with this year's round soon. But I know I was in the second round thinking, oh, I have this idea called the Journalism Doctor Telepresent Reporting Experiment. You can also find that somewhere. But anyhow, David, because he was under 25, they actually have another group for people under 25. They gave him $375,000 to go ahead and pursue this idea of Spot Us, which he built. And this is, how many people know Kiva? Okay, we'll get to Kiva in a second or two. So Spot Us, somebody comes up with a story idea, and it says, this is going to cost me $900 to do this story. And then people donate until the $900 is in, and then the reporter goes and does the story. Or it could come the other way. Somebody could be have a story they want to get done and said, you know, I'm willing to put up the first $100 as a reporter who will go and do this story if other people chip in money. So that's another way of doing it. And with these kinds of things, if you think about them, a lot of them won't get funded, so they probably shouldn't get funded. Some will, so they probably should get funded. And so this is a little funding mechanism. It's a total nonprofit, and it was built on my favorite nonprofit, smartest site ever created, Kiva. So do you want to talk about Kiva? Do you know a little bit about it?
No.
Okay, all right. So Kiva is brilliant. I mean, the people who thought about it in the nonprofit sector. Here's a person, Philippines, she's raising pigs. She's a hog raiser, her business partner is her husband, and if I click on that, it'll tell a little bit more of her story. And she's loan requested, is that just $100?
Yeah.
All right, nothing, right? So people around the world click on this and donate $25 to her. Four people will do it, she'll get $100. Most of them, they ask for like $1,000, they might need a refrigerator if they're a small grocery store or whatever it is. You give them the money, they pay you back. They pay Kiva back. They have a 97% payback rate.
Wow.
97% payback rate. So your money is always going to keep coming back. And then you kind of lend the money to whichever, there's tons of people who you can pick from. It depends, because it's so popular that they have trouble kind of getting on people. But, you know, there's women's co-ops, sewing, poultry. I always like bakeries for some reason, and I always try and find something in the bakery. So I have a few hundred dollars invested in here, but it keeps coming back, and I reinvest in other people. This thing is just so brilliant, the way it's constructed. And then you can also see, you know, you can see, well, you know, let me just see here. You can also see who all has contributed to the person, too. So here are the four other people so far who've given money to this. So it's really this, it's a term called crowdfunding. You've heard of crowdsourcing? Crowdsourcing is a whole bunch of people work together to get a project done. Crowdfunding is a whole bunch of people come together to get an idea. So I mention these two because of David Cohn. I'm on the internet. I'm writing about my idea. David picks up on my idea. I didn't know David before. We communicate a lot back and forth. And then we meet at some place, like in New York, at a meeting like we're having here. And we're kind of good friends. Generation gap, total generation gap. But we're both working on the same thing, and so are a whole bunch of other people, and we're all in communication. And it all happens because of the internet, and because we're like-minded on the same thing. Yeah.
I would just add something, because I know a fair amount about Kiva. Yeah. There's some interesting elements that it is on the ground, and it is on the web, because the way that it actually worked was that there was a partnership with people who had connections with PayPal, so that they get all the PayPal for free. So there were these alliances that really helped cover all the ground costs, which is why your money goes directly there.
Yeah.
But there are also on-the-ground partners, and actually if you research a little bit, and I've done, because I do international development work, some of the partners are better than others, some of the country partners, and you can see the timeline for the payback, even though they have good rates, some of them might be in delinquency, a percentage, and so there's just ways you can, there's a lot of information on there for a consumer, where you can do your own, like, charity navigation, which, as somebody who works out in the field and has seen a lot of different schemes for helping people that have different validity levels, it's nice to see that it's transparent enough that you can get information. And there were countries I wasn't comfortable with, because if you read a little bit, you can figure out that maybe their local partners are a little not as on ball as
originally. But here it is.
Partners.
Here's the field partner.
The partners, if it's too bad, they just say, we're not working with you anymore.
Right. But here, you can say, here's the field partner. And here's the risk, you know, it's they pay back. It's fundraising status, so they're kind of new. The, you know, Kiva entrepreneurs, 658 people have given money to it. Our 658 people are getting micro loans. They're getting loans. And the total loans are $250,000, and they haven't defaulted on anything yet. Now, they might, but the beauty of it is you can take your money out at some point. You don't have to leave it in after they pay you back. Now, originally when they did this, they would give they would wait until somebody got totally paid back before you got your $25 back that you lent. Now they do it on a rolling basis. So there's always another person. I probably have, you know, $150 sitting in there that I could go and click on various people, but I can't find enough bakers, you know what I mean?
I have a question, you know. I am from India, and I have not only from India, I actually lived in some of the most underdeveloped parts of India. And I would tell you, you know, that when the government, you know, typically hands out money, or they even right now, you know, waving off the loans and stuff like that, there's actually a lot of corruption, a lot of things that happens, which is on the process. And I looked at one kind of organization called Grameen Bank, and the person is actually a Nobel Prize winner, if you heard about him. And his model, whatever he has done in the model, has been actively involved in who they'll give loans to, and they typically go give loans to women and children, women and stuff like that, and they have a relationship with that. Okay, and this being a web developer and all that, this intrigues me. But at the same time, I'm a little skeptic about this thing, how it's working. And
well, here's the thing. Like, reporter from the New York Times was giving money to somebody, Baker or whatever it was, I think it was actually Baker, and went to the village and found the person and had a conversation with the person and found out it was legitimate. You know, and so a bunch of other people. You can go. You know who your person is. You can track them down and go talk and find out. And so is there potential for, you know, malfeasance? Yeah, yeah, but they have pretty good – these are partners who they know, and I'm sure people will try and rip them off. But in general, it works. I mean, you buy somebody a cow and they, you know, double their income. That's a pretty good thing.
Yeah.
So,
but this is purely for you. It's just charitable, so you're not getting interest, right? That's not the idea.
Well, actually, here's the interesting part about this. New York Times did a story, I don't know, 6 months ago, about a similar thing that's being run in Mexico. It's a for-profit operation that's run by a bank that actually collects interest on it, making it, it's the same sort of setup, but they're making money off of it. So that you think about on one hand, well, that's not, you know, this is not what I want to get involved in. This is one of the other things that kind of go on. And if you're thinking of these things, people will help out. People will really join in and help you out a lot.
Actually,
but only if they're sure they're not being taken as a sucker. If they think that they're getting sucked into something, you're just trying to take their money from them, they're going to go away really fast. But there's a book by Yoshi Bankler. It's kind of academic, but it's really well worth reading. It's called The Wealth of Networks. And he talks a lot about sharing nicely, the economy behind it. We all of us, share nicely. That's his argument. We give our blood, we give our sperm, we give personal service, you know, we help people out. We go to friends' houses and we look after them when they get sick and we help cut people's lawns. And there's a whole long list of things that we share nicely. But we only do it if we think there's a reason to do it, if we have a passion for it, if we think we're not getting taken advantage of, if somebody keeps asking you to wash the dishes over and over again, you're going to go away. And they're more apt to do it in an asymmetrical way, their own time, little granular. You have to think in terms of granular. Smaller the task, the more people you're apt to get to help out with it. That's why when I kind of read this thing and somebody said today, well, it's better to have 900 people working in 1,000 hours than 1,000,000 people working 1 hour. That came, when I read that thing about putting in that 1 hour and if 1,000,000 people do it on Wiki, you have 1,000,000 hours of work. That kind of stuck with me. So I try very hard to put in 1 hour a year on Wikipedia. Because I know if I'm doing that and 1,000,000 other people are doing it, we've done 1,000,000 hours of work. And that's another thing that Linus Torvalds talks about, and it's really important, and this is group work again. Linus Torvalds, he was the person who started the kernel for Linux, and he said, I know it's really unfair when I put in 1 hour of work and get 9 hours of return, 10 hours of return. And so if you can think in these terms with a lot of stuff you do, what is it that you can do that you put in 1 hour, 9 other people put in an hour, and collectively you get 10 hours worth of work.
The thing is, like, on the kernel these days, you can't put in one. You can't get anything done in an hour.
Right.
The stuff, you know, the kernel is developed to the point that the stuff that's left to do takes a long time to do.
Right.
And so it's not granular. And on Wikipedia, if you spend an hour over the course of a year, your stuff is not likely to be the same quality as someone who actually spends 5 hours researching something.
Well, here's what I did. And this is, I'll tell you exactly what I did. I went to the site called Civic Journalism on Wikipedia, because I know something about it. So, it could have been changed, I don't know. But it said, this article does not cite references or sources, okay? Well, I happen to actually know a lot of these sources. So I went in, and all of these little footnotes in there, I produced for them. And I put in the source for them. So that was good work, you know, and it didn't take that long, and it was an hour's worth of work. And it makes the site a lot better, because now you can go and, you know, you click on five here, and it's going to take you down. And I knew about this particular book, and I did a little bit of searching around. So all of these, you know, and I did, I don't know, 3 months ago or so, I'm pretty sure all of those references are references that I went out and found for them. So, yeah, that's the kind of sharing that I'm sort of talking about. I didn't have to do it. And I thought, why not? And I like the idea. If I was thinking I'm just going to put in an hour and I'm the only one putting in an hour, what a waste of time. But I think if everyone could think in that terms, you get 1 million hours of work done, or whatever that number of work is done. You know what I mean? Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I agree. I'm just saying that let's take it down to 1 minute.
Sure.
You know, what if a zillion people did 1 minute worth of work? You're going to have a mess, is what you're going to have.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to be the same as, you know, 1% of those people, you know, 1% of a zillion putting in 100 minutes.
Well, let's think about that for a second, because this is one of the things that I'll get to you. This is one of the things that I thought of, because I went out after I was thinking about Linus Torvalds, you know, 1 hour, 10 hours. I think, what is it that I could get done 1 hour's 10 hours? And I went and I sat on the campus to Kennesaw State at a bench. I was thinking about this, and I looked up and I thought, this is what life is about. Look at this campus that I'm sitting on. I'm one person who does one piece of work on here, but look at the whole campus. It's all group building, you know? And so everything we do, like I say, if you take things off-site, you know, the things that are going on kind of on-site and think about them off-site, we do it every day. We're doing little pieces of work that cumulatively, we're the ants, you know what I mean? We build cities, we do all kinds of stuff, and all of it is built on, some of it's because we have bosses, but a lot of it's just self-organized. But let me go to him.
Yeah, and that's not to mention the context of what you're giving an hour to at the same time. You're giving an hour to a particular article on Wikipedia that is relevant to what you're doing already. And that goes for each of us as well. There are activities that we're involved in, that each of us are involved in, that I would assume at least this, yeah, that we're already a part of or contributing to at some level.
Yeah.
Maybe there's an organization we're just giving, I'm just giving money to, but could really do a lot more for that organization by giving an hour of my time.
Right. And so here's when we're talking about social capital. So Griff Wigley, the guy up in Northfield, Minnesota, he started doing online community building in 1995 for the Hutton Cafe. He worked with me a couple times in Minnesota Public Radio. I came down here, started this public journalism network, asked him to do some early forums for me. He taught me how to blog. He's making me think totally different about everything I do. I get this grant from Ruth Ann Harnish. The first big installment was $60,000. I have to find a community now to invest that money and get the reporter. Well, I know that Griff has this website now with two other people that he blogs on. I know he knows a lot about social community building. So I contacted him and said, would you like a journalist, and we can work together? And he says, yes, of course I'd like to have the journalist. And I know, because he's built his own set of capital, that he's going to use the journalist really well, and I'm going to learn a lot. And so even though it's not costing them anything, the capital is being built. And so then we have somebody like, we're trying to figure out funding models, and now we have David Cohn with his Spot Us. And we can get in touch with him, and we start looking at his ideas, he starts looking at our ideas, and we're sort of noodling this all over together, and we have this real, I think when we think of nonprofits, we think only in terms of we got to raise money. But there's this kind of group collaborative work that's kind of going on. And it's got real, in my mind, it's got real depth and complexity that can make things happen that couldn't already happen. And there's probably 10, 15, 20, 30, maybe 100 people who I know there's 100 people who I know because of what I do on my blog around the country who are working on similar things. But there's probably 5, 10, 15, 20 of us who are constantly in touch, all trying to figure out the same thing. And we're making progress. It doesn't feel like it a lot of times, but I can't imagine how any of this would have happened without the internet. I just can't imagine.
So what collaborative tools, I use collaborative tools sometimes on the website, on my business, but what collaborative tools you use for a cost perspective on using people's good motives in solving a bigger problem?
Okay, so that's a good question. Anybody know about collaborative tools? Good collaborative tools? I mean, I work with Basecamp. That's kind of a, are you familiar with Basecamp? Basecamp is, like, you know, I'm not going to be able to get on my site because I'm not on my own computer and I forget the kind of URL for it.
Six apart, isn't it?
37 servers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Now, this is... Basecamp, we use it because I'm dealing with the people up in, let's see, I have, who's working on the project right now? There's the three bloggers, there's the copy editor, there's the reporter, we hired a researcher, so she's on the site, and then there's a couple other people who I work with on this. So there's six of us, and we use Basecamp, which basically allows you to send emails, but they're all at one place. And allows you to put up a wiki that you can collectively work on the wiki together, and allows you to upload files. So everything's in one place. It's really, they're called project management sites. And there's different ones. Somebody actually is here today, gave me a card saying he's got even a better one than this. And he said he would give it to me for free if I wanted to test it out. But I don't know what it is. But so these are kind of collaborative tools. I think this cost me $29, and then I can have. I probably have 10 or 15 projects that I'm sort of working on in different places. So, yeah?
Ning is actually a pretty good site.
Ning is a very good site for free for collaborative. So,
how much is Basecamp?
Beg your pardon?
How much is Basecamp?
Basecamp, if you only have one thing and you don't want a lot, it's free. You can get a free one. But I think I think it's $29.95 and a month, and I get like, I think 15, I can have 15 projects working with almost an unlimited amount of people. So here's Ning. And actually, there's a SOCON 08 Ning site, if you wanted to take a look, where we tried to get everyone afterwards. These are collaborative sites. And this one is called Media Geeks, but it's Wired Journalists. And it's everyone in journalism who wants to learn about improving journalism, you know, and coming up with new business models. It takes you 5 minutes. It's free, and anyone can come up. Of course, it's got these little ads, right? But anyone can come up and set up a Ning site. And it doesn't take very long. Here's the thing that I know. I don't know anything about technology, but I can do a lot of these different things. And so last year, after we had this, and some of these sites work really well.
Actually, it could be a blessing to not know about the technology. Because first time I saw the Ning, I had things to improve on. I was working on improving social media. Working on how I can press the message.
Yeah. So this is a site that I built last year. It took me a little while. People came to it for a while, but then they went away. And that's... You have to really be active in this thing. You really need a leader. You need somebody to go out and keep stimulating. There's a saying, which I kind of, Jay Rosen said, you can build it, but they might not come. And then, but Clay Shirky says, if you don't build it, they will not come. And then Bonnie Obremski, our reporter the other day, said, well, if they build it, they will come. So if you're doing these kind of sites, if you get people involved in the beginning of it, I think they are more apt to come. Yeah.
Also, I've done a Ning site. I was really shocked. You know, I just kind of I'd seen it. I'd been practicing on it in the early days of when I started doing this. We use this as an example.
Yeah, why don't you tell us who you are?
I'm Allison Hoag. And we practiced on this, and then I set
Again, Allison Hoag, what do you do?
The name of my company is Authentic Beauty, and it's a makeup studio, but it also has a whole social... a social component where we do inner beauty workshops with girls and women as well. So it's run by professional makeup artists rather than traditional makeup beauty company philosophy. So we started a whole blogging, and I didn't know what was going to happen with it. I just kind of set up the Ning site and then just invited everybody who was on our list. And within 24 hours, we had 60 people on there. Which, you know, now Facebook has really overtaken this for me, because now we have groups on Facebook, and it's way easier to just have one. For me, it's it becomes very cumbersome to have several different sites, where I just prefer Facebook because it just seems like everybody's just on Facebook, and then the people join your group or your cause or whatever it is that you want to set up, and then it's way easier to create discussions in a much simpler format, and then it gets posted on somebody's, you know, somebody's profile if they're signed up to it that says, hey, something's been posted. So that makes it much
easier. Do you have a Facebook for your just personal and then a separate identity for work and all these professional contacts? It's all just together?
It's all, you know what, I prefer it all just together at this point. It's about, you know, since the name of my company is Authentic Beauty, it's really about being authentic. Mm-hmm. And I choose just not to have a separate identity for that at all. I have a blog that's an Allison Hoag blog, and then I have an Authentic Beauty blog because one is my entrepreneurial, and then the other one is my beauty one, because, you know, I want to share about my journey as an entrepreneur and what I'm going through individually. And then I have one that's just the beauty one. Now, am I great at keeping up with either one? No, but that's my intention, is to be able to, and I'm actually getting ready to hire somebody who's going to help me maintain them all, because it is really important. And people are like, okay, will you hurry up and do this? Because they do want to follow it, so.
And you are?
Paul Arnold.
Okay.
One of the things that I actually have created a few new sites for certain purposes, and one of the ones that I did, actually the first one that I did, was a committee for the regional arm of my church. So we had folks from Alabama, folks from Tennessee, some from Atlanta, and we were supposed to be a committee to get something done. And what I found was that it's really good for communicating information and getting people to spread the word and let everybody react to what everybody else says.
Right.
And I found that it was horrifically bad for the purposes of generating a decision. And so it ends up that there's stuff that seems to work well, but the medium does not lend itself to other things that work well.
Yeah.
And there are other things that just don't work at all. So we ended up having to have a physical meeting to decide, because we just couldn't do it online. And I'm wondering if you've had experiences like that where the stuff works for some things, but it doesn't work for other things, and how you go about, or if there are different tools that seem to work better for something versus another.
Yeah, there are, but it's really hard to identify. So, like, how many of you are familiar with meetups?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're all familiar with meetups. So the interesting thing about, like, meetups is, you go to the site and you say, I want to form a group of people who only like pepperoni pizza, whatever it might be. And I know that sounds odd, but I keep coming back to this book. Here comes everybody, Clay Shirky's book. But one of the things that he points out about meetups, if you say, I want to have a mom's group to come together, you won't get anybody to come to it. If you say, I want to have moms with twins born in Korea, you will get a meetup group. And the reason is because they can't find each other except from that meetup. Moms can always find each other in the general kind of sense. So the more sometimes arcane, and that's what he found on meetups, the more arcane groups, like, witches from Atlanta, they have a lot of people show up for that kind of thing, because they want to be in that group, but they can't find any, or even male, which is then you even get more kind of people. So it just depends on your own particular need. Now, Ning was very popular, but I built my own, for the SoCon thing, the Medio Ning, and a couple others. I haven't seen it really be successful. And that's one of the problems. I think there's almost fatigue from these things, because you keep coming to them, and you got it stuck. So the one place that I spend my most time is with my own blog, frankly, But I still need other people. But I'm looking for you all is this taking you in the right direction? You got other comments? Yeah.
I guess I'll introduce myself first and then one comment. I'm Brian Pitts. I'm a grad student at UGA. I study public communications and online politics. And I'm also a staff member at Free IT Athens. It's a nonprofit technology resource center in Athens, Georgia. So I think I can kind of address your comments a little bit. But first, I wanted to throw out some alternatives to some of these tools like Basecamp for people who are a little nervous about using hosted solutions where you're depending on another provider and you don't have access to the code. There's actually open source software for a lot of these tasks. One is a Project Peer. It has a lot of functionality. It's very similar to Basecamp.
What's it called?
Project Peer. It's at projectpeer.org. And since Ning has become pretty popular, a good alternative there is software called...
P-I-E-R.
Yeah. So Project P-I-E-R.
Oh, P-I-E-R, right. Mm-hmm.
This software called ELGG, E-L-G-G, this has actually been developed by a lot of educational institutions that has a lot of the same functionality as Ning.
What's called?
Yeah. Yeah, so Project Peer, a lot of Basecamp functionality, and also ELGG.org. Well, software with a lot of the same functionality that Ning has, but they're both...
No, I had identified this product within my business. I needed them. But actually, what I found is that yes, in an internal business, we do projects and all that was fine. But the interfacing with this network and social media was what was the problem. I mean, you can manage a project, you can put tasks, and you can manage it and all that stuff. But how it interfaces and gets people drawn into the projects and what's been happening, how it communicates to the external world, that's what I feel.
This is why I recommend, this Yoshi Bankler's book, but I mean, one of the things he's telling, there are a set of reasons why people come to these things. One is reputation, okay? One is because they're passionate about the subject. Another is it's fun. Another is because they want to meet the community and they'd like to be part of that community. And then there's probably a couple others, but those are some of the things you have to kind of, there's almost like a little checklist you can go through to figure out whether or not people will come to it. And again, that other checklist that I said, they'll only come when they want to come. So here's an example of where they've mobilized people really, really well for, this is so when I worked with Minnesota Public Radio, I had to go out and bring people together, all right? And I said, physically, like we did. After I left, I was the analog for this digital space. So Public Insight Journalism, they have this Public Insight Network now. Minnesota Public Radio sent emails out to their listeners and said, would you like to be part of the Public Insight Journalism Network? You send us information about who you are. I'm a nurse, I'm male, 35 years old, have two kids, live in Bemidji, whatever it is. They fill out these forms. Then, when Minnesota Public Radio needs to find out what a male nurse thinks about AIDS, or whatever the thing might be, they can send an email to that person or those 50 people who fit that profile. They got 80,000 people now on this thing. Asymmetrical, that's another thing. They have to do it in their own time. You can't get them on real time to say, answer this right now. You put the question up, somebody comes home at night. If you have 50 male nurses, 3 or 4 will answer, and you get your answer. If you have a really bigger thing, you can ask a lot. You don't get asked very often. So you're signed up for this thing, and you're out there, and maybe, once a month you might get a question from them. Maybe once every 2 months. So granular, it's really small, they're not asking much. You can respond in your own time, and you only respond about what you want. But that really helps them, and not only has it helped them sort of get stories and get people involved, and then they have meetings. So sometimes they will find that there's a bunch of people who are interested about healthcare. They will actually bring them or invite them then to come down to Minnesota Public Radio, where they have this kind of forum area where people come and talk about the issues. Now, this has made inroads because they've got 80,000 people, and their number of people who have contributed to them has started to go up. Because people feel more ownership. They've always felt ownership in Minnesota Public Radio. And they trust it, and now they have more. So, inform our coverage. So here's some of the things. What's your experience with the court system? Are you an aging parent? Now, I think this is for radio, but why couldn't you do that for any nonprofit that you're in? Or something similar to that? We need to figure out how to get more blood donors. What do you all think how we can do it? And you could target, who your blood donors were and try and find out, for example, why Latino people give blood as opposed to why people who live in rural areas give blood, or whatever it is. You could really start breaking this thing down and get a lot of people to participate. They feel like they're part of it and get ownership. So these are just, you know, some things that are... This, I know the journalism sphere the best, and I kind of know what's working. Now, a lot of stuff doesn't work. That's the other thing you have to kind of keep in mind. Failure is a good thing, because that means at least you're trying stuff. And someone else said, for innovation, you start with a project that's out here, and, you know, this is how big companies apparently do it. You start with a project up here, and half of it doesn't work. But now you have the half that does work. And you move to the next level, half of that doesn't work. Move to the next level, half of that doesn't work. And eventually, you get something that works pretty good. And this whole idea of beta testing, open source, you keep putting ideas out there over and over again, and your users tell you what's wrong with it, and you keep fixing it and doing that over and over again, and then you get a pretty healthy, robust product, supposedly. Go ahead.
I was just going to point, we had some interesting, I was talking about this last night, I guess, at the dinner, some challenges. I work with a lot of social justice organizations, and trying to make use of a website or some source, and when we did the Georgia Progressive Summit, we used Campaign Window, which, because Angela Trigg and Trigger ID, which has that, it's a pretty easy site. You can get a free website if you're willing to have ads on it and free hosting, and then you can pay. It's like $100 a year, and its design is a very simple for very, you know, you can't customize a whole lot. They have a lot of interesting tools that are not always used, where you can have different levels of access at the back end, and you can have groups meeting, and so there, it's a flexible tool for those people that need something quick and easy without being a programmer who needs special bells and whistles. And they've added, and they will add if there's a certain thing that you need done to it. And we raised money, you know, we had registration, we didn't make use of all the tools, because you could have groups, for example, like you're talking about, with volunteers, people have volunteered before, you can have contacts that has a back-end content. So we started with a Joomla site and, you know, got free hosting for DreamHost as a nonprofit. It was just too hard, we didn't have the technical support, so we had to go with an easy something. So it's just an idea for those people. And it's designed for people running campaigns who have very low tech skills and need to get something up and running right away with simple means. But it has a back end that has more.
So how many of you know MoveOn.org? So people either love it or you absolutely hate it. I think MoveOn.org helped me save the nation, because I'm a liberal, so that's why I believe that. But they... 2 years ago in the election, 2006, you had a website that you would go to, and I didn't care a thing about MoveOn.org. I was really angry because I knew my vote wasn't going to count in Georgia. And I'm trying to think, how can I make a difference? They gave me a website that I could come on and I could call districts around the country and try and get the vote out for various people in those districts that were... And it was smart, because you could do it till 12 o'clock at night. So you could use your cell phone from 9 o'clock and it would keep moving across the country as you were making the calls. And a little screen would come up, they'd give you a phone number, you'd call the people up, you'd ask them to come out. Now, the first thing I noticed, which really amazed me, is that only 1 in 4 people answer their phone. You know? So that's the first part. You're going to not get a lot. And what they did in the beginning, in the first part of it, they used the first part to kind of cleanse their list. So the more people you call in the first part, if they yelled at you or didn't want to talk to you, you kind of pushed the little button, and then move on and knew that. And then when it got closer to the election, for the second round, you could call high prospects. But I called all these people, and I'm thinking, this isn't doing any good. You know, if one person or two people come out to vote because I made all of these calls and spent all these hours, it'll be a miracle. But I thought maybe a couple would, for that conversation. But then I read that 90,000 people were doing the same thing I was around the country. So if 90,000 people are doing it, and each of us got out one vote, 90,000 votes. 30 districts around the country were in play. Divide those 30 districts by those 9,000 votes. That's 3,000 votes a district. That made the difference. I changed the history of the world thanks to MoveOn.org.
Thanks, Lynn.
But you know, I mean, that's the kind. If those are the kind of tools, if you come up with the right tool, look at the difference it can make. And I didn't care a thing about MoveOn.org. I was just really angry that I had been disenfranchised. In fact, if I hadn't been disenfranchised here, I wouldn't have done it, because I don't know, just gone around to my neighbors and maybe talked to some neighbors. I wouldn't have put all this time in. But I was so angry, and suddenly it was like this liberating force that they gave me a tool that I wanted to use. And it's so. Where else can you do that? I'm not sure. But it's that kind of smart thinking of using the internet and collective work that's just amazing. And, you know, I got played out this whole idea, you know, the term crowdfunding. So you saw it in Obama's election a lot. There was Michelle Bachmann. I don't know if you know that thing, Michelle Bachmann. She's the legislator from Minnesota who called Obama unpatriotic, a terrorist. And so all of these people said, let's send her opponent money. Elvin Tinklenberg. Elvin Tinklenberg raised $3 million in like 24 hours.
Really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. It was a big story. You know, overnight. And people kept sending money. She almost lost the election because all of these people chipped in their money. So this is kind of the power of these things. And Obama is another example. The Republicans had more rich donors, but when you have a long, spread out, you know, group of people, nobody can beat them. It's almost like if you think when, you know, the whole crowd rebels against the sort of elite group, you can't hold them back when that happens. But you can do it in a positive way, too. If you can get masses of people to contribute a little bit, they're a force that no one can stop. So that's what I'm trying to think about in my mind, how we can mobilize.
Again, for good. I didn't agree with the Republicans, and I was inspired by President Obama. But a lot of things, his goals and visions and all this are inspiring.
Right.
But then we are actually not in a very different kind of position. And I have some solutions. And again, I have not a very well thought out solution,
right, but
a solution at a high level. I think they have a good chance of success. And I, so far, being still at internet market and all that, I have not done justice to my idea at all. And what I'm trying to say, the solution actually are some ideas in which the home-based business will come up. One of the ideas I'll share with you is like the logo. So this is like I have a shirt and my logo, and then I have a message. So it's having custom message, custom branding, and then creating that in homes and stuff. And there is a lot of different ideas, a lot of businesses, and then people can add to ideas. And then the home, if you get out of it, that's one. And then how we can use the education as a means of change and workforce, which we have not done, and it's been too expensive to study here. So we are losing competitive advantage over other countries like China or India and other countries. So, I have these ideas, but I have not known how I can put the structure together to get it all happen.
Yeah.
So,
I think you have, let's just say you had this idea 10 years ago. I don't know how you did.
Today,
you have a chance at least. It's a long shot, but here. Again, what you have to do is sort of find other people out there, and you sort of network with them. So David Cohn, I see what he's doing. I talk to him. He talks to me. We share information. I'm into his network. He's into my network. And the bigger these networks are, so somebody like earlier, you know, there's Jay Rosen, for example, on Twitter. And Jay Rosen has 5,000 people who follow him. He's really well thought of in this public journalism. So the other day, the New York Times actually ran an editorial on the New York Times page, op-ed page, about creating an endowment to buy the newsroom for the New York Times.
Oh,
well, I did. I countered with another idea that I had that I thought was a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
And I then know that Jay Rosen Twitter's on this, and he had mentioned the endowment thing, so I hit the reply button, and I said, Jay, take a look at my idea. He took a look at my idea, and then he said, you should take a look at Len Witt's idea. It's a pretty good idea. Now, he's really well thought of. That brought in almost one of the top thinkers, a guy named Vin Crosby, comes to my site and starts commenting on my site, and I have a dialogue with him. So suddenly now, Vin Crosby's audience, his network is my network in some ways, and they know me now. My social capital, because of one little tweet, increased. There's no doubt about it, because now people who might have been looking at my work, I know now they're looking at my work. They didn't agree with me, but we had a decent dialogue.
A lot of this started with your blog.
It all started with my blog.
Can you just give us some, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, some of the things you learned? I mean, it took a long time before anybody ever commented on anything, right? How long did it take?
You know, they still don't comment a whole lot. Sometimes I get a lot of comments, but it took me a couple of years, but I was a little early in the area. But remember, that, you know, this was in 2008, but remember, we're talking a niche. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to blog about the economy, you're probably not going to get very far.
Right.
Yeah.
If you blog about how to buy, I don't know, shoes in the economy, something really small, some little niche, you know, then I think, and you blog about that, and then you connect other people, you go to their site, you comment at their site, and, you know, they see you. If you put a link to them, they're going to put a link to you. And it keeps kind of growing that way.
Were there other lessons you learned along the way, or was it pretty much just regularly putting stuff up there that was...
You know what? I didn't care. You know, in some ways, I mean, I want an audience. Everyone wants an audience. But it wasn't my primary thing. My primary thing was I just wanted to have this public file cabinet, which I use all the time. I mean, I use it all the time. My memory isn't that good sometimes. And I can go and I find stuff that I wrote 2 years ago. And I go, oh, my God, I didn't even know I wrote that. You know? And so then I go, and this happens all the time, you know? And so then I go and I have this information. So when I go to give a lecture or a talk, and because it's linked, I have all that. So there's that. But there's also this just idea of being in communication with all these other people who are talking about the same issue. And we're just, you know, I mean, a lot of people, many of them are much smarter than I, and they just kind of lift me up. Sometimes I might lift them up a little bit, you know? But together, we just kind of keep moving forward, and that's the kind of thing I think you want to do, is you want to think as collectively, you want to, this guy, Eric Von Hippel, who told me about free revealing, you know, he has a book out, and he talks about free revealing. Give your idea up. Jay Rosen says, if you can't give away an idea, you don't have enough good ideas. And so, you know, then, now there's the issue. So Von Hippel says, put your idea out there, let people see it, you will be recognized for having that idea out there first, and you'll probably prosper by it a lot more than if you think, this idea is going to make me $1 million someday, and I'm not going to give it away, and nothing will happen, the idea will die in your head. Now, there's some people who that's not true of. You know, if you think you can start the next mountain bike and you can put together the capital and everything else, well, go for it. But he said, put the idea out there. Well, that's what I did with my representative journalism. I steal this idea, everything else, and lo and behold, today, I've got $1.5 million because I gave my idea away, which is, doesn't seem right. But.
Yeah. Again, the blog, I find that, so you, suppose you write a blog, and I had written a blog, what I found is that how we can have this blog, and yes, offline I can go to Facebook or LinkedIn and find the right people, and then offline and send them an email, or maybe with a link to that my blog. But from the blog that we are writing, say WordPress, whatever you use, or a website you're using, whatever, how you can search on the blogs or on the people who have interest in this idea or some kind of stuff, and how you can market your blog to them online without going out of your blog.
I just put in, go ahead.
Just very humbly, I mean, I'm pretty new on Twitter.
Yeah.
And
your name is in your...
I'm Bernie Schneider, actually. I've been meaning to introduce you. I'm on the MHPW LinkedIn group.
Okay.
That I should be doing.
Oh, good. That's the Masters of Professional Writing here at Tensor.
And I'm fairly active on LinkedIn through a couple of groups and new on Twitter, but mainly because I'm trying to explore the space and learn more about it. But I have this sense that there's a... false emphasis on numbers. People are very, very focused on the numbers and not so much about the content. So I think what you say is if you're actually engaged in a significant conversation with somebody and
you have interest, mutual interest, I think that naturally leads to a broadening of the network. So you don't really have to put this, I think, in organic growth, to me, makes much more sense. I once met a guy who said, connect with everybody on LinkedIn. You want to have 10,000 followers, but to me, that doesn't make sense. You know, the organic growth, there seems to be so much more worth in that.
I totally agree with you. I mean, if somebody wants to have 50,000 like followers like Robert Scoble has, and that works for him, it builds his reputation. But I'm just as happy to be talking. And in fact, what happens, if you grow too big, you become a celebrity, then you lose the relationship that you had. Celebrities cannot have the same relationship on the internet that I can have. They can have more numbers and everything else. They can't have the same relationships. Because they get so many people come in, they can't respond to any of them, and they kind of lose them, and they need to get a PR agent or something else. Although, whereas I can talk to everyone I know. If I send an email to them, I'll get a really fast response. And if I have a question from them, they know what I'm doing. You know, they're all aware probably now, but we just made it public this morning about the grant. They're probably all aware of that, and I'm going to have all kinds of information coming in. And so I like that intimacy.
Although I'm not suggesting that numbers are bad. I think you know, if you have 15,000 followers and people are interested in your content, fantastic. But just chasing the numbers doesn't.
I agree. I agree. I mean,
to me.
But I still look at the analytics on, you know, I don't know if you know Google Analytics, behind the scenes, those, you know, I look at that frequently and think, and you know, so when Jay Rosen picked up on my post, I could see the next day, you know, five times more people were coming to my site than normal.
One of the things that's happened to me is I actually started a blog on open source, and I've killed it. And the reason that I killed it is because it didn't serve the purposes that I was trying to achieve because of the comments that I was getting. And what it was on open source software, and I ended up having a commenter on my blog whose name was Daniel Wallace. Daniel is a retired physics professor who thinks that he's a lawyer. And so what he would do is he would read all these cases because he doesn't have anything else to do, and he would concoct all of these theories that absolutely don't work. But when you've got this much text with all kinds of sites in it, it's very difficult to refute immediately. Now, he's the guy who sued IBM, another open source company, for monopolization. I mean, you know, he's completely out there. And so instead of being the provider of good information related to open source, I was the provider of false information about open source. And so what I'm learning about that is that the tools can be used for a lot of different things, but you have to match what you're trying to do with the tool. And if you don't have a good fit between them,
Here's another example of that. I think it wasn't Cosmo. It was one of those teen magazines. You set up a social network for girls with anorexia so that they could, you know, work together and work through the problem. Well, when all the girls came up, they kept giving each other suggestions of how to
eat more
and how to throw up and all this terrible stuff. They had to close it down because it had exactly the opposite expectation that they expected. So we never know what's going to work, you know, but you don't know until you go out and try it. So I think, yeah, it's time to give it up. Yeah, go ahead.
This is one thing he was asking about other blogs to find. There's actually, that I just discovered, something called Comment Hut. And Comment Hut, you can put in your topic, and you can find all the blogs.
Perfect.
It's an application.
So Comment Hut?
Comment Hut.
H-U-T.
And I was able to find, you know, you can get a free subscription, and then you can pay more to get more detail. But it was very helpful to me. It'll show you how many people have subscribed to the blog and what the larger blogs are for a particular topic. And I was able to find out some of the key ones inside my industry. And, you know, it's very helpful.
You know, Technorati, I mean.
Yeah, Technorati, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Technorati kind of does the same sort of stuff, you know. So
this is where you can find like-minded bloggers or something?
Yeah, so I mean, I can, what I do to Technorati when I come to it with PJ Head, you know, I can find out who mentioned me recently. So, you know, as I said, I mean, I know I have a worldwide audience because somebody linked to me from someplace, you know. I'm not sure where it is. I don't even know the language, but they linked to me, you know. And so, you know, blogging advice from Jay Rosen's complex, I use my name in there. So this is an international audience, and that was like 17 hours ago. And then, you know, the social media. So I can kind of know who's talking about what I'm interested in. I can follow them. They follow me the same way, I'm sure. So, yeah. Living proof for worldwide audience.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much. I enjoyed it. Hope you did.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on Magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of Unconcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.